This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Privatization and ANC Submission to the Dictates of Capital. This is part two of Mass Strikes Expose ANC Betrayal of the South African People. Let's bring on Ralph Poynter for a further update on the case of Lynn Stewart. Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning, Maya. How are you and Ralph making out on the West Coast?
We're doing fine. And how is Lynn doing?
Well, Lynn is wonderful. You know, she's her same political self. She went in jail sick. She's still sick. Prison is the worst place to fight it. We need a furlough and the worst way to get her out to deal with her medical condition. But one of the things that she said was, in this electronic age, how is it that they can isolate people? And she was thinking about the issues out here. And she said, I wish I was out here to fight the issues. And I said, well, the reason why you're in here is they don't want you out here fighting the issues, telling the truth in the way that you tell it, the way that you get listeners. And she was saying that she hopes to see you in there, Maya. Ralph was turned down for an interview as a security risk. And so she says, well, I wonder if Maya could get in. I know that you're going to be on her email list soon. Her main source, her only source of finding out what's happening in the outside world is listening to this radio program. And you know how big a part you and Ralph are of this response to what's happening in the world. So, she says, keep up the good work. Ralph should reapply again. You're going to be on her email list, and maybe we can continue the dialogue, and maybe we can get her voice out here.
Yes, we're going to go after them hammer and tong, Ralph, absolutely.
And meanwhile, Ralph, I understand there's a new appellate lawyer team.
Yes, you are the first to get this announcement. There is a new appellate lawyer team. It has not been solidified just yet. We are very happy with the team. We are putting it together. We will be making that announcement soon. Now, Lynn wants a press conference. I will be speaking with you and Maya to make sure that you're a big part of this press release that's going to be made regarding her attorneys.
So that everyone understands, Lynn is going to appeal the resentencing by Judge Kotel, the resentencing to 10 years.
And we are going to fight, as Lynn said, don't speak of her as yesterday. Speak of her as now, because she's going to continue the struggle. She's not beaten until she quits, and she's never going to quit. The struggle continues with much help by my dear, 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 wonderful comrades and friends, Ralph and Maya.
Thank you so much.
Ralph, you will be with Ralph, and the two of you are speaking at an event that's September 10th at 6 p.m. It's sponsored by We Are Change at the All Souls Church.
And thanks to Luke, who was the inspiration of We Are Change, who is putting Ralph and myself on to discuss Lynn's case.
And that will be at 1157 Lexington Avenue. And the next day, Saturday, and also on Sunday, there's a conference at which Ralph Schoenman here, is speaking, and that's How the World Changed 9/11.
At Walker Stage, 56 Walker Street, and throughout the conference, between all panel discussions, Ralph will be holding forth on Lynn's case to edify and to illuminate the issues for all those participating in this important conference, How the World Changed After 9/11.
And that conference is at 56 Walker Street, Saturday, September 11th, and Sunday, September 12th. It runs from 1 p.m. through 10 p.m. at night.
And I want to thank Lenny Charles of International News Net, who is the architect of this event, along with Luke. And thanks to Les Jameson for his good work in alerting us and in mobilizing people for this event. All out, brothers and sisters, for the International News Net conference.
For details, go to howtheworldchanged.org. Or call 206-338-0319.
And Ralph, we're looking forward to your presentations at all these events.
And I'm looking forward to giving everyone updates on what Lynn is doing, what she's thinking, and what she's saying.
Terrific. Thank you, Ralph.
Hey, looking forward to seeing you and saying hello to all of the inmates along with Lynn at MCC.
And remember, everyone, come to the events at All Souls Church and at the Walker Stage, 56 Walker Street, this weekend. And now for our program. Mass Strikes Expose ANC Betrayal of the South African People, Part 2. Privatization and ANC Submission to the Dictates of Capital. Monday, the 20-day strike that began August 18th of COSATU unions representing 1.3 million South African public sector workers, government workers, teachers, hospital workers. They announced on Monday that they had temporarily suspended, that is, called off, a three-week-long strike to allow their members to consider the latest government offer. As we mentioned last week, the ANC-sponsored government of President Jacob Zuma had capitulated after it said that it wouldn't meet the demands of the COSATU workers. The workers were asking for an 8.6% wage hike. This is in agreement with wage increases that took place in the private industry weeks before with auto workers who received even higher wage increases. The government did come up to 7.5% and also increased its meager housing allotment.
Well, Maya, it has to be emphasized here that it was certain specific COSATU leaders and those associated with the Communist Party in South Africa that were placing the pressure on the workers to accept a settlement that was considerably lower than their demands. But I think it's important to emphasize that this took place 2 days before the private sector workers were scheduled to go out on strike. The miners, the auto workers, whole sectors of the working class ready to join in this strike so it would have doubled in size, an extraordinary step to pressure the workers to suspend their demands 48 hours before they would be joined by the private sector, creating the objective conditions for a general strike. It testifies to what kinds of role this bureaucracy in this union is playing in not being able to derail the rank-and-file rage and demands of the South African people, but seeking to contain it.
Ralph, the white teachers' union were already going back. They had done a calculation that to stay out the additional wage increase, to move up to 8.5% from 7.5%, wouldn't match the money that they were losing by staying out. However, Thabile Ntola, president of the South African Democratic Teachers Union, the 230,000 teachers who are represented by SATU, said, "We're taking this offer on the table back to our members," but already the members of SATU said that they thought it was an insult from the government.
Maya Klisklopper, the leader of the white smaller teachers union, who spoke at the news conference and stated that the strike had effectively ended and that it had lost its impetus. And he said, "Once I showed my guys the figures, they said, let's call it a day." This was a roundly denounced declaration by not only Ntola, but by rank-and-file members, even of Klopper's union, not to mention the larger black teachers' unions who were outraged by this capitulation.
Ralph, you mentioned the solidarity strike that was going to take place last Thursday with miners. Other miners, the biggest platinum mine in South Africa, went on strike anyway. The Northam Platinum Complex. Their strike began Monday, September 6th, as the public sector workers were suspending their strike. There are 8,000 miners of Northam's 8,600 total workforce. It was a series of walkouts, and these workers are represented by South Africa's National Union of Mine Workers, and they want a 15% wage increase, and Northam is only offering 8%.
Well, let me emphasize, Maya, that the Northam strike has a special importance because it is the mine that produces virtually all the platinum of South Africa. So consider the impact of this, because this is the biggest platinum mine in the world, and it is a central feature of the capitalist control of the lives of the people of South Africa, gold and platinum, which are anchored not only in Pretoria, but above all in the City of London and the IMF and the World Bank, and that it to sustain indirectly the status of the dollar and the pound sterling. So these workers are at the center of the struggle against capital in South Africa and globally.
Now, if you read the New York Times and you read The Guardian and you read the capitalist press, they repeat over and over again that essentially that the workers are being unreasonable, that they're asking for wage increases that are twice the inflation rate, and that the government cannot afford to spend money on these workers' demands. And if they were to meet the workers' demands, then the unemployed, the large unemployed force of South Africa, 43% officially, and probably up to 60%, that they wouldn't be able to get jobs because the government couldn't create the jobs. This is bogus. This is the government propaganda, because let's look at the contradictions in South Africa. A significant article by Patrick Bond of Monthly Review, South African Public Sector Strike Highlights Society's Contradictions. He notes particularly Pretoria, that is the South African government, subsidized the World Cup to the tune of $5 billion by most estimates. And this included more than $3 billion on stadiums, that is money to the large construction companies, not to the workers, that are now widely recognized as, quote, white elephants, unable to fill the stands and too expensive for the soccer teams, the local soccer teams.
They were a handout, Maya, just a rapine handout. The corporation sponsoring the tournament took home more than $4 billion in profits, tax-free, without exchange controls. The workers who had to service that event get not enough money even to feed their families or themselves. $4 billion tax-free profits, that in addition to the $5 billion that were basically handed over to the corporate entities that were involved in this event. I mean, this is a measure of the role of the government in its servicing of large capital in South Africa.
Now, we had mentioned that more than 1 million of South Africa's 13 million workers in the formal economy, we're not talking about the informal economy of people on the streets trying to sell this and that item or working under the table, that more than 1 million of the workers had lost their jobs since 2008. Meanwhile, all these billions of dollars, not millions, not hundreds of millions, but billions of dollars to subsidize the soccer games. But what they're really subsidizing is the large corporations. But also, in addition to the vast spending on these stadiums, which are now not going to be used, there's been vast spending on infrastructure, notes Patrick Bond. There are four major components to this infrastructure spending. Two new coal-fired plants, $35 billion, seven times the amount spent on the World Cup, $35 billion, financed partly by the World Bank, and then a $3 billion fast train that goes from Johannesburg Airport to the main financial district. Definitely not a train that is used by the workers.
A $1 billion airport in Durban, multi-billion dollar dams for the big mining and agricultural interests, which, as Patrick Bong states, benefit the elites at the cost of infrastructure for the poor, who are living not in houses but in kennels, half the size of those allocated in the Bantustans by the apartheid regime.
Let's look at this contradiction. Billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars to these white-owned businesses in South Africa. And this is the ANC government that is doing this. This is not the apartheid government. If we look at an article by Liban Mabasa, president of the Socialist Party of Azania, SOPA, he gives very clear detail of what the conditions are like for the workers and the bulk of the people of South Africa unemployed. He notes, Maize meal, the staple food of the country's masses, is fast becoming a luxury item. In a few years, the prices of necessities have doubled or tripled. Milk, cooking oil, margarine, forget about butter, soap, soap powder, Vaseline, toothpaste, vegetables like onions, tomato, pumpkin, spinach, beetroot, and potatoes are now out of reach, the staple foods for the people. And it's worse for fruit and medicines. What are the teachers, nurses, and doctors expected to do in the face of such attacks, he asks.
Worse still, Lyman writes, a mushrooming of bakeries is selling substandard weight and nutritional value. Bread, which is barely edible, without any nutritional value, is the order of the day. The large corporations continue to fix prices of bread and basic commodities, including medicine. In the case of bread, the government response was a token 100 million rand fine, and the price of bread shot up anyway.
Ralph, we talked about the rise in the price of electricity with the privatization, and today we're going to go into detail about this privatization. There was a 27.5% rise in the cost of electricity and more than 17% in food, 20% in interest rates, and 35% in fuel, and that's only from May 2007 to May 2010. And the fact that the worker started off at very low wages, a vast disparity, this provided the basis for the strike. If you'll recall, we had discussed the strike in 2007, where the COSATU forced the workers back. They were very unhappy with the settlement. And once again, the workers are in the same situation.
As Lyman says, couple this with the ever-escalating joblessness, a recipe for revolution is brewing. The power struggle within the ruling party will ignite the powder keg. The leadership of COSATU is scrambling. They are attempting to contain the workers, but the workers are clamoring for a political break. What is at issue here is the desire, the passion, the mobilization, and the will of the workers and the masses of South Africa to struggle for not token formal rights, but for power. You can integrate the beaches of Durban, but as long as Harry Oppenheimer owns the mines, the masses will be starving in South Africa, whatever the nature of the bureaucratic apparatus that sells them out.
Ralph, let's look at the ANC capitulation. Three decisions were crucial. One was to drop nationalization, which had been part of the ANC program. And they dropped this in 1992. The major industries in South Africa were nationalized. The second decision was to repay the $25 billion of apartheid-era foreign debt. And the ANC made that decision in October of 1993. The third decision was to grant the central bank formal independence. In other words, it was no longer a central bank, but it's like the Federal Reserve here, when they developed the interim constitution in November 1993. A few weeks after liberation in May 1994, South Africa joined the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. They agreed to the deindustrialization of South Africa. In January 1995, that privatization began in earnest. I would like to add a fourth decision by the ANC that led to the situation today, and that has to do with land ownership. 80% of the land is still owned by 62,000 white families, white institutions, and white interests. This means that the majority of people are not able to get a place where they can build housing. Instead of appropriating the land, 80% of the land remained with the control of the white population.
Yes, Maya, and in addition to that, the state raised water and electricity prices dramatically to the point where they consume 30% of the income of those households earning less than $70 a month. 10 million people had their water cut off. 10 million were victims of electricity disconnections. Municipal statistics show that 60% of the disconnections were not resolved. The blame lies with the poverty that has been the consequence of capitulation. It is, in fact, the core concession made by the ANC during the transition deal that black nationalists have the forms of power, but white population in the form of corporations remove their capital from the country and continue to reside in South Africa with greater privileges than they even had under the apartheid regime.
Ralph, in terms of the flight capital, you're referring to the fact that the ANC government allowed the corporations to move their headquarters, many moved their headquarters to Great Britain, to England, and they took their companies off the South African Stock Exchange and moved it to the London Bourse. While the industries and the people remained in South Africa, the actual financial structure moved offshore. They took their profits offshore.
Well, Maya, in 1999, Laban Mabasa and the Socialist Party of Zania asked me to participate in preparing an election program for the elections of that time. And I went into some of the issues here that you are just mentioning, and I'd like to reference it. Three giants of South African business, Anglo-American, South African Breweries, and Old Mutual, are already on their way to London, according to Finance Week. Finance Week, the principal financial and journal in South Africa, approves the following declaration. Integrating the South African economy into the world economy is the major challenge for us in the past 4.5 years. What that meant in practical terms with the centers of apartheid capital shifted outside the country the vast fortunes stolen from the people. The ANC subordinated all economic decisions to the dictates of the global financial markets. 1 year before, Anglo-American took its capital out of South Africa without one word of opposition. It did so, moreover, when the raid on Asian currencies by the U.S. devastated not only the capitalist economies of Asia, but was a major factor in the destruction of jobs in South Africa itself. Remember, said Finance Week, the turbulence on international currency markets and the significant impact this had on South Africa. Soaring interest rates, a plunging rand, never more severe than when Ango, as the crucial example, got the green light from the ANC to shift its operating center to London. South African capital fled under the ANC government to invest in markets offshore, seeking profits not by investing in Azania, even on a capitalist basis, but by merging into global financial speculative funds, the fictive capital that produced the later collapse when the banksters were handed $23.7 trillion in reward in the United States by Barack Obama. James Cross, the deputy governor of the Reserve Bank, noted that South African companies took $27 billion out of South Africa in 5 years since 1994.
27 billion rand.
Yes. The ANC government was reduced to begging corporate capital to preserve the stability of the rand. But residual investment in Azania would continue only if taxes and controls were further dismantled and if returns on investment matched what they could obtain in the speculative global financial markets. Thus, the future offered the people of South Africa by the ANC was more unemployment, greater disinvestment, and deepening inevitable misery. What, quote, said Finance Week, if Anglo and the others continue their expansion outside South Africa, especially since one vital effect, in fact the prime attraction of moving to London, is that it's no longer necessary to get permission to borrow on the world's capital markets. Yes, that could happen, they say. Not only could it happen, but it was guaranteed. By fleeing the country to the greener pastures of speculative returns, apartheid capital was disinvesting in South Africa itself and abandoning the country's economy. The social cost of drawing foreign investment is more intensive exploitation, if it comes at all. Trade union protections were targeted for removal, and after that was imposed, Finance Week made clear that the prospect of South African capital turning away completely from investing in the country was as imminent as it was assured. Quote, that possibility is a reminder precisely of what is involved ultimately in joining the global economy. Any country that wants foreign fixed investment must offer solid attractions. If South Africa can't attract its own companies, it can hardly expect to lure others, unquote. The workers and rural poor of Azania were abandoned by the ANC government. Quote, the bottom line is that South Africa has no option but to assure It passes the test of international business approval, unquote. And that, last week, we showed in the interview between Jacob Zuma, president of South Africa, and the Council on Foreign Relations, in which he groveled before them as they demanded that he impose ever greater austerity and facilitate flight capital. The ANC government, we wrote at the time, in forfeiting control over capital in and out of Azania, has demonstrated its inability and disinclination to act in the interests of the people. The regime of Mandela and Mbeki functions exclusively as the junior partner of apartheid capital, a central component of the problem and the major obstacle to its solutions. All its policies proceed from the premise that the rate of profit for private capital is the sole measure of whether, when, and in what way productive investment can occur in Azania. The role of the ANC decision-makers in the arena of apartheid capital was celebrated by Finance Week in an article featuring a full-page cover photo of Cyril Ramaphosa, but recently the second-in-command to Nelson Mandela. Ramaphosa now has $43 million in personal assets apart from his corporate shares. He lives in an exclusively guarded preserve of the Afrikaner elite, no longer a resident of Soweto. His reputation as deputy chairman of the New Black Investments, called NAIL, is that of a power player in the rarefied atmosphere of, quote, New Black Investments. He represents not Soweto, but Fawawa Holdings, five family trusts which control a conglomerate network of black empowerment companies, large sums of money placed at the disposal of a select ANC cadre as junior partners of finance capital, entirely that of the apartheid regime, reinvested by these administrators of capital into black-run investment firms. As we said at the time, they may be black mice among the albino elephants of apartheid capital, but they are plump mice.
We will pause now for station identification. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Mass Strikes Expose ANC Betrayal of the South African People, Part 2, Privatization and ANC Submission to the Dictates of Capital. I want to repeat the points of how the ANC betrayed the South African people. One, dropping nationalization, which had formerly been part of the ANC rhetoric. In April 1992, the ANC dropped the nationalization and accepted privatization of the national industries to repay the $25 billion inherited apartheid-era foreign debt, and that decision was made October 1993, to grant the central bank, which would be controlling the currency decisions of the government, formal independence in the interim constitution, and that they did in November 1993, and fourth, to maintain the land as it had existed in the apartheid era instead of seizing the land and turning it over to the people. 80% of the land is still owned by 62,000 white families, white institutions, and white interests. Let's look at South Africa in its industrial structure and also the economic structure of South Africa. It's a country that could have great riches in terms of its mineral wealth. In 1910, the nationalization process started. And as Engels had noted, capitalists like to use the state to create the infrastructure for their industrial growth because the infrastructure is not considered profit-making. And so the state, as in Great Britain, creates national industries such as railways. And this happened in South Africa. In 1910, the South African Railways and Harbors Administration was created. Later, the services included the Ministry of Transport, Posts, and Telecommunications. The government of South Africa created then public corporations, which were called para-statals, and they were given exclusive franchise in certain industries. And these industries provided the infrastructure for capitalist development and control of the economy. Eskom, the Electricity Supply Commission, was created in the 1920s. Eskom developed into the fourth largest producer of electricity in the world. But with the ANC government, it was privatized. 30% of it was sold in 2004, and the first step in the 1990s was to cut 30,000 jobs. Another state industry was ISCOR, the Iron and Steel Corporation, and that was established in the 1920s. The Phosphate Development Corporation, PhosCor, which controlled the mining and processing of phosphate minerals for fertilizer and other uses. Sasol, the South African Coal, Oil, Gas Corporation, which was primarily involved in the production of coal and its use for synthesizing gasoline. The Southern Oil Exploration Corporation, SOCOR. The Postal Service. The Postal Service, in addition to providing postal service, operated a subsidiary parastatal, Telkom, which provided the telephone services, and 30% of Telkom was sold to a Houston-Malaysian Kuala Lumpur alliance. 20,000 workers were fired. Then there's the South African Broadcasting Corporation. For a while, there was only one channel in South Africa that alternated between English language and Afrikaans programming, and that is the SABC, the South African Broadcasting Corporation. And in terms of the defense industry, the war industry, ArmsCor, initially called the Armaments Development and Production Corporation, later the Armaments Corporation of South Africa, and it not only developed small arms and ammunition, but military vehicles and military optical devices, as well as we talked about the rail lines. The first parastatal, created in 1910, when it was privatized, many of the feeder routes which reached the outlying areas where the African population of South Africa lived, they were canceled, and it cut access to the rural communities. Last but not least, the South African Airways, the SAA, the state airline of South Africa. And as soon as that privatized, it led to its collapse. Ralph.
Well, Maya, it's important to note that Patrick Bond, who writes in the Monthly Review and currently wrote as well in 2004, he had always been a supporter of the ANC and of the South African Communist Party and the role of COSATU. But his documentation is ruthlessly honest, and I special credit to Patrick Bond for the meticulous honesty with which he reports the reality. Contracts are renegotiated to raise rates on the workers because of insufficient profits. Services have not been extended to the poor. Low-income residents have been disconnected. Prepaid water meters have been widely installed. Sanitation has disappeared. Across South Africa, the dogma of 100% cost recovery from the most impoverished led to the continent's worst ever cholera outbreak, catalyzed by mass disconnections of rural residents across South Africa in August 2000. As a result of the consistent failure to deliver, alienation and discontent are vastly increasing. According to a 2002 survey conducted by the Liberal Institute for Democracy in South Africa, the number of Africans who believe life was better under the apartheid regime is growing. Tragically, over 60% of Africans polled that the country was better run during the apartheid regime. Only 1 in 10 believe their elected representatives are interested in their needs. Fewer than 1 in 3 felt the current government was more trustworthy than the apartheid regime. In fact, for 10% of the wealthiest whites and a scattering of rich blacks who enjoy segregation and insulation from the vast majority, Patrick Bond writes, lifestyles remain at the highest level in the world. This is evident to any visitor to the slightly integrated suburbs of South African cities. racial apartheid was always explicitly manifested in residential segregation. And after liberation in 1994, Pretoria adopted World Bank advice that included an avoidance of public housing. No municipal or even cooperatively owned units were constructed. So the consequence of this is that 9 years later, the provincial housing minister responsible for Greater Johannesburg admitted to mainstream newspapers that if we are to integrate communities economically and racially, then there's a real need to depart from the present concept of housing delivery. And he writes, the low-cost housing is being eliminated entirely. What is the result? Black residents are confined to structures that are termed kennels. Hundreds of thousands of post-apartheid subsidized starter houses are half as large as the 40-square-meter matchboxes built during apartheid and located even further away from jobs and community amenities, in addition to ongoing disconnections of water and electricity. These vast slums suffer lower quality services ranging from rare rubbish collection to dirt roads and inadequate storm water drainage. How did the degeneration of a once proud liberation movement occur so decisively and so quickly? He writes, it is attempting to point out that the neoliberalism dictated by the IMF was codified in gear, but three prior decisions were crucial. They dropped nationalization from the ANC rhetoric, they repaid the $25 billion inherited apartheid-era debt, and they granted the central bank formal independence.
And, Ralph, we add that they didn't turn the land back to the people, so that we have four steps of the ANC. Let's look a little further at this debt, this $25 billion apartheid-era debt. 22.2% of the budget in South Africa, that's almost one quarter, goes just to interest on the debt. This is about the same that is spent on education. Such a colossal proportion should go to social expenditure, and infrastructure is going to the international banks. And an important article by David Hempson, South Africa Report Archive, In Debt to Apartheid, which was written in February of 2000, goes into a lot of detail about this debt. I would like to mention something more about this huge public debt. All this was incurred before the ANC government came to power. According to Professor Ben Turek, the chair of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Finance in 2000, one-third of the debt was incurred before 1990, one-third between 1990 and 94, and one-third in the period of 94 to 96. The enormous increase in debt from 1989 onwards was marked by political factors, including the extraordinary costs of military and police, most of which was aimed at destabilizing, at destroying the mass democratic movement. So we have here the ANC and COSATU and the South African Communist Party, this collaboration between the three in agreeing to pay the apartheid era debt. They are agreeing to pay the debt that was incurred for the military and police action used to destroy them. Another significant factor of the apartheid era debt was the apartheid government trying to secure the pensions, guaranteeing the pensions of the apartheid era white infrastructure. Towards the end of our show, we want to discuss what it means to nationalize the economy of South Africa. In building up South Africa with the British and the apartheid governments, what we had was nationalizing the infrastructure in order to prop up the growth of the capitalist economy. And then now with the ANC, the capitalists are privatizing this national infrastructure. An article by David Van Wyk that was written February 6, 2010, talks in great detail about the debate on nationalizing the mines in South Africa. The demand for nationalization in this time period is being put forward foremost by Julius Malema, the leader of the African National Congress Youth League, the ANCYL. Julius Malema is saying, and the Youth League is proclaiming, that the mining industry foremost in South Africa must be nationalized. And they base this demand, it's predicated on fulfilling the vision of the Freedom Charter of the ANC, which was adopted at Cliptown in 1955 and was the manifesto of the liberation struggle. As we mentioned, the ANC dropped its own charter.
Well, Maya, David Van Wyk writes the following. The move from Johannesburg to London of the two major corporate financial headquarters, Anglo American PLC and Billiton, caused concern over capital flight. And the government blocked a $3 billion merger of Goldfields and Franco Nevada Mining. But it approved the $19 billion takeover of De Beers Consolidated Mines by Anglo American. In reality, it facilitated flight capital and the capture of the entire economy of South Africa by the very apartheid apparatus.
Ralph, let's look at the statement in the charter, what Julius Malema repeats over and again. According to the ANC charter, which was negated by Nelson Mandela and Cyril Ramaphosa and the others, and now Jacob Zuma, the ANC charter had stated, "The wealth of the country shall be shared among all who live in it." The conclusion of that is that you must have the nationalization and the control by the population of that wealth. There's no other way that they can share in it. And that means the moves towards socialism, not the moves towards collaboration with the capitalist economy. Ralph, this article by David Van Wyk, he notes, let's look at the mining industry in South Africa. The underground workers, the miners, earn $400 a month, and that figure has not changed in many years. The average wage of a Canadian mine worker is $2,607 a month. The Canadian mine workers therefore earn 6.5 times more in 2005 than the South African workers earned in 2009. And yet South Africa has greater mineral wealth. Since the late 19th century, South Africa's economy has been based on the production and export of minerals, which have contributed significantly to the country's skewed industrial development.
Well, consider this, Maya. Gold is currently trading in the United States at around $1,200 an ounce, which translates into $38,400,000 per ton. Platinum trading at $1,450 an ounce, $46,400,000 per ton for platinum. What do you think the workers are getting paid? Not even starvation wages. These colossal billions, indeed trillions, of profit extracted from the blood and sweat of workers over generations are sustaining capitalism on a global scale, and servicing that is the ANC government.
In 2000, mineral commodities accounted for 47% of the nation's total export. 47%, almost half of the exports of South Africa, were mineral commodities, gold, diamonds, platinum, and other metals and minerals. And this has continued year after year.
Well, Maya, as Van Wyk writes, 47%. The total sale of primary minerals was $14 billion in 2000. $11 billion was exported. $9 billion in 1999 had been exported. Given these staggering export figures, one is left, he writes, with the uncomfortable question as why, in the midst of such vast wealth, are the issues of unemployment, mass poverty, disease, and homelessness assuming such equally staggering proportions?
Ralph, the national gem diamond output in 2000 was, this is a staggering figure, 4.75 million carats. Natural industrial diamonds, 6.06 million carats. De Beers mines produced 10.29 million carats from 23.3 million tons of material that was treated. staggering figures that do not go to the South African workers. South African diamonds gave employment to 2 million cutters and polishers in India, whereas in South Africa, there are roughly 2,000 cutters and polishers. In other words, the mineral wealth of South Africa is mined. The workers do the mining, but the actual development of these diamonds and other minerals are done on the international market.
Maya Van Wyk writes, the two African countries lauded for being democratic, capital-friendly, and responsible, both by their governments and by the International Monetary Fund, are South Africa and Botswana, two of the most extractive industry-dependent countries in the world, with between them the worst gaps between the rich and poor in the entire globe, the worst HIV infection levels in the world, both suffering massive unemployment. There is no second tier in the South African economy, he writes. Those classified in the so-called second tier are the working class, the poor, the unemployed, the excluded, the vast black majority, the African part of the population. They are a product of the form that capitalist development has taken in South Africa since the discoveries of minerals in the late 19th century.
Ralph, let's return to the Freedom Charter and the demand. Quote, the mineral wealth beneath the soil, the banks and monopoly industry shall be transferred to the ownership of the people as a whole. This is exactly the opposite of what this ANC government of Nelson Mandela, of Mbeki, of Jacob Zuma now have been promoting. Ralph, to conclude.
Maya, 6 years ago, I was asked by the ILWU to make a presentation on the 20th anniversary of Local 10 having challenged the apartheid regime in South Africa and led a campaign for the boycott of South African goods. I wrote and said to the ILWU at the time, apartheid was not merely a system of racist oppression and discrimination. The apartheid regime was designed to crush resistance to exploitation. The white settler minority monopolized the land. It controlled the political system. It ran the economy in the name of the privileged few. The removal of the racist regime was a giant step forward. What has happened, however, to the people of South Africa since that triumph tells us that apartheid is alive and well, if somewhat masked and disguised. Today in South Africa, the land remains in the hands of the privileged white landholding minority. In fact, the same identical people who owned and controlled the land under the apartheid regime own and control it today. Unemployment in South Africa is over 60% in real figures. The shanty towns not only remain intact, but are three times larger in population and size. AIDS and systemic disease are rampant, engulfing over 40% of the population. 70% live below the poverty level. Impoverishment prevails. The financial centers that ran the apartheid regime remain in the hands of the same corporate and banking oligarchy, with a veneer of black participation as minor members of the boards of directors. What have we learned? That you can integrate the beaches of Durban. But as long as Harry Oppenheimer owns the mines, black workers will live in shantytown poverty at starvation wages when they, if lucky, find precarious employment. Apartheid South Africa was the financial engine that sustained the pound sterling and the U.S. dollar. It was the control of gold and diamonds that defined apartheid South African stock exchange and its decisive role in the City of London and Wall Street. Today, these relations remain intact. The same oligarchy holds the financial strings. Black governance is confined by minority white economic power. The symbol of apartheid was the apartheid debt, billions loaned to the apartheid regime to fund its repression. The torture chambers and the mass killings were financed by Wall Street and the City of London, no less than by the handful of rich white owners of South Africa's mines and industry. The payment of that debt in compounded interest annually was passed on to the black workers, the inhabitants of the Bantustans, the shanty town dwellers, the brutalized farm workers, the vast army of the hungry unemployed. Today in South Africa, the unemployed and the hungry, the mass of African workers and farmers are paying the apartheid debt. The people of South Africa are funding the debt of the apartheid regime to the tune of $6 billion a year in compounded interest, and vanishingly small percentages of this extorted and usurious profit is applied to the principal. No. The apartheid debt is recycled, compounded usury interest taken from the labor of black workers and their families, stolen from the national wealth that is still monopolized in the financial hands that held it under the apartheid regime. So the struggle continues, and the fight for emancipation is unfinished. Apartheid lives as long as the people lack control over the economic life of their country. Apartheid punishes as long as people labor for little and live in slums while the wealth of the country is monopolized by a parasitic handful of mine owners, speculators, stock market manipulators, and the great foreign investment houses of Wall Street and the City of London. National independence is a precious thing, but office without power is a cruel deception. Whether in South Africa or in the United States, where 1% of the population owns more than 95% of the population combined. It was fitting that Laban Mabasa, co-founder with Steve Biko of the Black Consciousness Movement, spoke on October 17th at the Lincoln Memorial for the Million Worker March. His message to us was clear. Cancel the apartheid debt. Land to those who work it. Workers' control over the means of production and the fruit of our labor. We can best honor the brave initiative launched by ILWU Local 10 in launching the anti-apartheid movement in the House of Labor by standing with the workers and farmers of South Africa in demanding cancellation of the debt and power, all power, economic, no less than the forms of governance, to the people in South Africa, in the Americas, and throughout the world.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Mass Strikes Expose ANC Betrayal of the South African People, Part 2, Privatization and ANC Submission to the Dictates of Capital. It will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. We'll be with you next week. Saturday, and also on Sunday, there's a conference at which Ralph Schoenman here, is speaking, How the World Changed 9/11.
At Walker Stage, 56 Walker Street. And throughout the conference, between all panel discussions, Ralph will be holding forth on Lynn's case.
And that conference is at 56 Walker Street, Saturday, September 11th. And Sunday, September 12th, it runs from 1 p.m. through 10 p.m. at night.